Radio Influence. Podcasting redefined. This is Landry Football on Radio Influence. The only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Welcome in to this Thursday, June 6th edition of the Landry Football Podcast. As we get going to today, we're going to talk. Got a few things on the topic today. Got a couple of really, about four interesting questions that have been sent in by you. Remember, if you've got a question, we can get to it right here on the Landry Football Podcast. So send me an email. Go to LandryFootball.com, hit contact Chris. No contracts to send in a question. Contact Chris and send me a question, and we will get it here. Got a few things to get to, but we are at the stage of halftime adjustments in our X's and O's series. You're wondering, hey, we're going to get you through the rest of the game. If you have not followed the previous several podcasts, I encourage you to go back and do it. They're free. Go to LandryFootball.com and you can listen to the past several podcasts, and this will make more sense to you as we talk about how a playbook is formulated. First of all, we talk about the best way for you to educate yourself a little bit more about watching games, what to look for, what to chart, to get a better feel for what it is you're truly seeing. Then we talked about how we put together a playbook, how that playbook is formulated to the practice field and in a game week. And then we tell you what happens from the end of the previous game to the start of the next week, and we take you through that process. And Tuesday we left you with, okay, it's game plan, it's game day, and this is what you do during the game day, this is what adjustments you make, so on and so forth. And there we are. We've taken you to halftime. Now we're going to take you through the completion of the game. And if you're wondering what's next, we're going to take you into the all-important position of the quarterback position and telling you a little bit about how that, I think it's the toughest position to play in all of sports. We're going to go through why, but we're going to tell you what they go through. You're going to have a better understanding and appreciation for what it is they have to know, what it is they do, and how they do it. So we're going to get to that as well. Do want to get into, I'm going to take a couple of questions first, and then we're going to get into the halftime adjustments, and then we want to keep some things fresh here. Got some ideas I want to get through with the previewing some college football elements, some NFL free agent elements. We'll get to that time permitting. If not, we'll certainly jump on that early next week. So a question that I wanted to get to off the top. By the way, reminder, what we got going on at LandryFootball.com is breaking down rosters in college and the NFL, keeping you up to date on what's going on daily, multiple times daily in college and the NFL. So you want to check that out. Our daily notebooks give you a ton of information that you want to be on top of. That's the first thing. Two, it tells you what's going on in the OTAs, tells you what's going on in the personnel moves that teams are making. And then college, tons of recruiting information, tons of film room nuggets. We get you ready for the football season. We also are breaking down all the rosters in college, grading players. We're also breaking down the NFL roster. So you want to check us out at LandryFootball.com. So I'm going to start with the question today, go in a little bit of an order. Kevin asks, he references the Tuesday podcast, where I answered a question relating to quarterback's accuracy and the degree of which it can be improved. What about other positions where certain innate qualities sometimes reign supreme? And you use some examples, vision for running backs, instincts for linebackers, ball skills for receivers. Well, there are innate things. For running backs, the innate things would be just the quick twitch muscles of being able to stop and start, the burst that you have, those are innate. Vision is innate to a point. I mean, literal good vision, being able to see and have things slow down. Great hitters in baseball can see the ball better. You know, you hear things like the great Ted Williams said that he could see the strings of the baseball. Now, I don't know if that's, you know, an exaggeration or what, but bottom line is he could see very well. Don't think that doesn't have a lot to do with being able to just sharply see where the ball is moving, the ball is turning. Well, having great vision is important for skill position athletes because catching the football, seeing things peripherally is important. So you can't understand what you're seeing if you don't see it at a very high acute level. So vision is basically innate. You got it, you don't have it. I mean, you've got different degrees of it, of course. But I think what you're asking about is vision for the ability to be able to, you know, see the holes and understand. Well, that to me, it's always been about understanding blocking schemes, understanding fronts, understanding play design, understand what you want to get done. And those things are not as innate. They're taught. They're things you can get better at. Instincts for linebacker. Well, again, as a linebacker, great vision, great awareness of what's going on around you. You know, some people are very perceptive about what's going on around them. Some people are not. That's in any business, sales or what have you. It all takes place. Linebackers that can see and recognize and, again, have the wherewithal to be able to kind of see what's coming, meaning you can see things in movement that you just peripherally see. That is just natural, you know, vision. But understanding, just like a running back will understand blocking schemes and fronts and where the play is going to go, well, so does the linebacker. They're the opposite end of the running back in that they're trained to understand blocking schemes, understand responsibilities of the defensive lineman, interchanging responsibilities, understanding what gap you have, understanding what gaps everybody has, and making the adjustment to it. That can be learned. And that comes down to love of football, desire to learn, and the ability to learn. The capacity to learn and willingness to learn, right? So I hope that gives you an idea of some things that are innate and some things that can be learned. Ball skills for receivers you bring up. Well, there again, that's eye-hand coordination. Look, I can and tell you that when I was young, my eye-hand, and this is not often talked about a lot. We think about a guy that gets into his mid-30s, and you think, well, this guy's slowing down physically. And that is true, that there's a bigger adjustment physically to, you know, the regression of a player. But we automatically think, yeah, but boy, he's got great vision. He sees things because he's seen it before. Yeah, you see things better experience-wise. You've lived more football, so you see it better. But in real life, usually, and it's different for everybody, usually it's to about the age of 40 that your vision starts to adjust. You know what I mean, right? I mean, what is it usually when you get to 40, you know, reading glasses start to come on. Now, not everybody has it. Some people have to have, you know, corrective vision, you know, when they're 10, 12 years old. I actually had glasses as a youngster. And so it varies, of course. But we don't focus enough on that your vision changes. And while you may have better, quote-unquote, air quotes here, vision of experience, very often as you get older, your coordinative skills of being able to seeing and reacting is not as good. And so what I was getting to mention is I can remember, and I'm older, so this is not a great comparison, but when I played, I had, I thought, exceptional ability to see the football and catch the football and react to it. I mean, it just, there was great clarity. I can still close my eyes and see myself seeing a football, seeing the spin on the ball, seeing maybe like a mark on a ball, and it really helps when you see the spin, you almost can glide with the ball to it. And then as I got older, my vision started to change. And we're talking, say, from high school to college. For some reason, it wasn't quite as good. Or in certain condition, weather conditions, wasn't quite as good. It wasn't quite as clear. Well, that is an important aspect to understand, that sometimes you literally, vision, your vision doesn't look as good. You're just not as good. You're not seeing as well. I'm anticipating better because more experience, but you don't see it quite as well. So there's a part of that. Great eye-hand coordination is so important for the skill athlete. An infielder or an outfielder in baseball, a receiver, a back, defensive backs, judging the ball. I mean, how many times, you know, people say, how the hell could he miss? How could that defensive back miss? The guy was right there. Very simply, it's just doesn't quite see it as well. We do a lot with vision testing and visual acuity that really helps to determine. Basically, the eyes have muscles, and the ability to be able to, those muscles to be stronger, to be able to adjust to see it and focus quicker. We're talking milliseconds here. It has a tremendous impact on what you do and how you play. I mean, so, you know, it's not just vision of saying, well, Magic Johnson and Larry Bird had, you know, eyes, you know, behind their head, and they could see guys on the court. Yeah, they could. But they also had the ability with the eye-hand coordination to be able to adjust to that quicker than most, and that's why they were such great open court passers and, you know, could be able to look off and still see from a timing standpoint to get a perfect pass to a teammate. Those things are important. So, yeah, absolutely, this is why people laugh, because they don't understand it, why we do all these sorts of tests. We don't talk about it enough. I tend to do it around the combine, but we talk about the vision test that we give them, the eye-hand coordination. They're things that measure it, but it also shows up on film too. But you need to do a little bit more, just, you know, because if you're a receiver on a really good offense with a really good quarterback that throws it a bunch, you're going to see a lot more out of that receiver, what he can or can't do. He's going to have more chances than somebody who – let's say is not in as good of a offense that features that, and the guy may be just as skilled and have just as good a visual acuity, but it may not show up quite as well in the results. This is why we do these tests. So there are innate qualities, but what I would say, it's kind of as human nature. There are certain skills that you're born with, but there's certain things are learned. Why is, we always say this, don't you have some people, I'm not one of these people, you might be one of these people, that are good with their hands, meaning they can fix things. They can look at things and see how they work and fix it. They're good with carpentry or woodworking or mechanical work or electrical or whatever. Is that innate? I don't know. To be honest with you, a lot of it has to do with your interest level. Do you want to learn about it? You know, at some point, somebody has to learn it. In most cases, Well, you grew up around somebody that was good with their hands, so maybe you did things with them and you gained an interest in it and you learned how to do it visually or orally, and all of a sudden you became good at it yourself. Maybe you're good at something that no one in your family ever did and no one in your family had the same type of skills. Where did you learn it from? You were really interested? Did it come naturally? I think some of that is natural. Some of that is learned. Where the line is, often difficult. From a football standpoint, just over the years, you have a pretty good understanding. Just because a player had a dad that played pro football doesn't mean that this guy's going to have the same amount of passion and love. He may have a better understanding, but he may be different. He may have more of his mom's personality, who may not feel the same way, or, you know, maybe even more. I mean, you can look at these things to get an idea, but you really have to look at all angles and study it and say certain things are innate, but certain things, and I think most things, are learned. They're societal. We grow up around it. You have a desire to be good. You know, most people that are good at something is because they like doing it. It's just as simple as that. You know, some people say, I can't cook, I can't do this. That's because you probably don't like doing it and you don't want to spend time to do it. You don't want to really learn how to get better at it. If you wanted to, you probably could be pretty good at it. It's just the way it is. So you look at the skills. You study kind of and try to drill down as to why they're good, but don't ever underestimate the ability of a player to get stronger. You can get quicker and you can get faster. With strength, you can improve it. But you're not going to go from being a slow plodding guy that's going to be a speedster. Okay, you're not going to make that drastic of a change. If you got thick ankles, you're not going to ever be able to run really well. Thick ankles means you're going to be slow. Slender ankles with a long Achilles heel, you've got the natural God-gifted traits to be fast. Doesn't mean you're going to be fast because maybe you don't train to be fast. Maybe you don't develop your other muscles as well. That's why we always like to know, how does a guy like the weight room? How does a guy like to work out? Well, if you don't like to work out, you're going to do what you need to do and get the hell out of there and do something that you like. If you're somebody that loves the weight room, that means you're constantly trying to get better. You're constantly trying to look at something to get better. Why are you a good coach? Why are you a good scout? Why are you good at anything? Because let me look at a little bit more film. Let me look at this angle. Let me look at that angle. Let me do this. It just, if you love it, that's how you get good at it. Most people think they're good at something because they like it, but they don't have the time to do it because they've got work and other things. Well, if you don't spend as much time as the next guy is probably going to be better than you. It's just the normal way it is. And some people are a little bit brighter at some things than others, and that comes out. So I think they're definitely things that can be improved that people don't think can be improved. But you normally would understand what those are. Awareness, understanding of the game, work ethic in the weight room, training, nutrition, all those things can get you better physically. But you're not going to completely get better. I mean, I use this example because it's the one that people talk about the most. What did you miss on Tom Brady? What you missed is how competitive the guy was, because you didn't really see a whole lot of it. And people, you know, listen, I'm not going to make excuses or take up. I had a third-round grade on Tom Brady, and guy was a sixth-round pick, and he's a Hall of Famer, maybe the best of all time. Well, what didn't I see? Well, let me tell you what I did not see. He didn't play a lot at Michigan. When he did a fairly decent job. He had no body development structure. He had no strength. He had no athletic ability. And while he was a good kid, he did not test all that well in his on the board and understanding of the game. Well, he didn't have a lot of experience. So it's obvious that he had it in him, but there was no evidence to that. Oh, you know, he used it as a motivation. That's great. That's wonderful. But the reality is there was no evidence that what happened was going to happen. But it is a perfect example of you never know. What did he do? He became ultra-motivated. I mean, what does the guy do at over 40? He eats an incredibly nutritious diet that fuels himself beyond his years. He loves the game. He loves to compete. And he wants to continue to do it and do it and do it. He's got a chip on his shoulder. He's made a chip on his shoulder. He constantly refers to it as that. I mean, he wants to be great. He's got himself stronger. He's not very athletic, but he understands how to move in short steps to create extra time to throw the ball. His arm is not as strong as it used to be, but it is stronger than most people would be at his age because he's kept himself in the shape, and he's done the things. And, of course, he studied the game and seen a lot and worked with one of the best coaches to where he's made himself a great player. So that's really a long-winded answer, went into a lot of things. It's a great, great question and topic. Kevin also has, suppose you were coaching a 3-4 defense. It was mandated that your linebacker core had to consist of one red grade, one blue grade, one purple grade, one orange graded player. Generally, what would be the best configuration? First of all, I think you're missing something there. You would never configure it that way. You would not want to have one red, one blue, one purple, and you never want an orange graded player. Okay? An orange graded player is a backup caliber player, and you want to seek better. Now, you will have some of those guys, but if you've got, remember the adage, read the website, replace your oranges, right? Now, you've got orange-graded players on your roster at times that can stick for a while if they're blue or red-graded special teamers. But you don't want, you would never want to say, I need to find me an orange-graded player. No, you never seek that. You seek to replace that. I understand what you're saying, and blue-graded players are rare. Red-graded players are not as rare but are really significant. And purple-graded or starting caliber, you want to have purple or better. And ideally, you want to have as many reds as you can. And you're very, very fortunate if you have blues. And you're not going to – it's going to be hard to keep many of those. On a 3-4 defense, what you're really asking, I think, is what's the most important and where would you want to put them? First of all, the 3-4 defenses have changed over the years. The 3-4 defense in its principle is a two-gap front where you control two gaps. You got a nose tackle that controls either side of the center and the defensive ends that control either side of the guard. That is the two-gap front, the 3-4. Today's 3-4 is a little different. What you have is a lot of one-gap 30 fronts. And most of those are, even the two-gap fronts, they're not running 3-4 in nickel. So even the 3-4 teams are 4-3 55% of the time. And I think that needs to be understood. So you have to understand the criteria that you're looking for the position. I'll answer it in the way of what you probably intended it in a original 3-4 defense, which I learned from the guy that invented it, Bill Orange Parker. In the 3-4 defense, you've got to have an elite edge rusher that can be a stand-up rusher, rush from a two-point stance, and also rush from a three-point stance, but he needs to be able to rush for the in the interior from the perimeter. And a nose tackle doesn't have to be elite. A nose tackle is really important, but they don't have to be elite. In fact, what you're looking for in a true two-gapping 3-4 nose tackle is a guy that's big, girthy, and just strong as an ox. You don't worry about pass rush. You want to be able to clog the middle. And then the defensive ends have to be guys that are strong enough to control the line of scrimmage and not, again, be the primary rushers, but to be guys that can control the line of scrimmage so that the linebackers can clean it up. The linebackers, the inside backers, have to come up, take on a guard if a guard slips one of those blocks and has to get off a block. So the inside backers have to be more physical and strong. The other outside backer has to be able to set the edge against the tight end. And so if I were to look at it and say where the priority, I would want to have, if I had a blue grader, I'd want to have the edge rusher to be a blue grader. And I'd like, you know, I could live with purple graded or low red grade defensive ends and nose tackles. I'm okay with that. You can live with that. What you have to do with that front, though, is in the linebacker position, the inside backers are going to have to be solid purples and the strong side linebacker as well. So if you were going to look at it, and I could say I'm going to take one, first of all, you've got one blue grade, that's going to be the edge rusher. If I'm going to take a red grade guy, it's probably going to be one of the defensive ends. Then the rest of them could be purple, and I could run a pretty good defense, but can't have an orange graded player and be successful consistently. I mean, you can, but you're going to have to hide it. That's how the front would come out. Kevin also asked about the revised game injury report, which, you know, the most recent one's 2016, and the probable status was eliminated, and the injury players were classified as questionable, doubtful, or out. Okay, and he's talking about a statistical chart which is available from 2017, and talked about the disparity from top to bottom with respect to questionable and the percentage of time a player did or didn't play. Said the Steelers only played 27% of the time when questionable, while the Bucs players played 93% of the time when questionable. Your knowledge of the organization, is it this degree of disparity caused by the policy just being too vague, gamesmanship, and or medical interpretations? It's gamesmanship. It's pretty clear what questionable is, doubtful is, and out. It's, I would say, 98% gamesmanship and philosophical approach of how you want to label players. It's questionable. It's question. Now, you could say, well, what's questionable? Well, questionable is questionable. It's too vague. I could give you, maybe I'll go 95% and say 5% vague. I think it's pretty, I think it's out's clear, doubtful, the way it's supposed to be classified, it's doubtful is 75% out. It's doubtful. 25% is giving questionable. You know, the probable part is where I'm taking this, in that when they took that out is because it was more gamesmanship. Then you were seeing a lot of guys that probable and that weren't, you know, they're just not being honest. Let's call it what it is, cut to the chase. It's gamesmanship. It's not being honest for competitive advantage's sake. Jacob asks a great question that's always fun. He says, look, his best college quarterbacks of all time. Archie Manning 1, Roger Staubach 2, Tim Tebow 3. How bad did I miss, Jacob asked. Jacob, I don't think you missed at all. I think there's always going to be debate. People are going to see it based upon their time frame. I agree with all the guys you mentioned. Archie Manning was great. Roger Staubach was ridiculous how good he is. Tim Tebow was probably the biggest and best winner. They were all great. I could give you some more guys that I think were really good. But I don't think you missed any of those guys. Who did you leave out? I don't know that. Look, I mean, I would say a guy that was very good that probably belonged in terms of success of what he did is Danny Werfel. I would say Werfel, Tebow, and Manning, in any order you want to put them in the SEC, were great. I don't know. The Big Ten, you know, a lot of guys, you know, you go back in Greasy at Purdue. I think Drew Brees, Troy Smith were really, really good. I think you look at the ACC days, you know, Deshaun Watson recently was good. Vic was good. Charlie Ward was good at Florida State. Vince Young was good. You want to go back. You want to go back a long time, and I've looked at a lot of film on them. I obviously didn't see them play. Hard to find anybody that threw the football better than Sammy Baugh at TCU. God, was he good. He was great with the Redskins. Man, you talk about innate ability to throw it to spots. This guy had it. Good Lord. This guy could take a rock and throw it on top of a frisbee, you know, 40 yards into the ocean. I mean, and just he was just something. Sam Bradford was a great quarterback. RG3 did a great job. Tommy Frazier was great running the Nebraska offense. Those are some, I don't know, Southwest Conference, Big 12 guys. Luck and Mariota and Leinart were good recent years in the Pac-12. John Elway was great at Stanford. Jim Plunkett was great at Stanford. Terry Baker was a great quarterback at Oregon State. Dan Fouts was a great one at Oregon. Dan Marino was outstanding. You mentioned Roger Staubach. Steve Young and Ty Detmer were two of many great ones at BYU. Cam Newton had one great year. I think I mentioned Vince Young. How about Doug Flutie? My God. How good was he? Your list is really, really good, Jacob. I think you nailed it. And there's no one on that list that doesn't belong. I mean, could you add more? Yeah, and you probably could if you wanted to, but I don't think you missed at all there. All right, let's get into halftime adjustments. So we're at halftime in the final minutes of the first half. Let me start there. You have the quality control on each side that's in the booth. Will leave the locker room ahead of everyone else, the other coaches. And you get in the room, there's these big grease boards, and you set up, because I've done this, you set up a statistical breakdown on the whiteboard of everything that's gone on thus far. First and 10. At 7 runs, 6 passes. Run average, 3.2. Pass average, 11.0. Second down, in 3-6, one run, 6 pass. A run average, 5.5. A pass average, 6.0 completion. This gives the coaches a little bit of a feel material to use in determining what adjustments are necessary and to spend the brief time that they have with the players to go over what's working and what's not. Because of time, I think it's important to keep things simple. So a lot of coordinators say offensively, you want to keep it simple. So you'll take every play that's gained 4 yards or more, and you have that delineated, and we'll run that again in the second half. We're going back and using that. If you've been tracking the game like we talked about a few podcasts ago, you can anticipate what coaches are discussing behind closed doors. You should already kind of have an idea based upon what you've charted and what we've talked about. Now, you're not going to do everything in the first half, so you're going to have some things that are on your down and distance sheet that you didn't use in the first half that you think might work. You briefly discuss it, talk about it. Now, what you do with your play call sheet is you modify it with denotations of what you want to go back for and with. That's why a lot of these guys, they have these little pens, these little Sharpies that they'll make notes on as the game's going on and in the halftime. So you will, and there's place for adjustments and notations to where you can go back to this, star that, so on and so forth. So you don't want to redo the whole game plan, but you have to modify it based upon what's working and what they are doing against you that you didn't anticipate. You can identify quickly 3, 4, 5 things that you can do, but if you start changing completely, you're going to confuse players. You're going to have a lot of missed assignments. You didn't practice it enough, so they're not prepared for it. You're better off doing something that you know how to do and do it better than trying to do something different that you didn't work on as much, because that's not how you saw the game being played out in your mind. So you got an idea what you want to do. The coordinators have to communicate with their assistants, the position coaches, and remind them of any checks that need to be reviewed. And then flag any plays that weren't practiced during the week. So you might want to resist that, okay? You got to do all this in under 5 minutes, okay? And then the position coaches meet with the players and they give the adjustments to their specific assignments to their positions. It's about a 2-minute, 3-minute meeting. Then you got to go back on the field and put all that knowledge to use. So the team that not just has the best game plan, but execute the best game plan is most of the cases going to win. You have situations that you need to look at times. And I want to get into why you do things. And it is not to justify or excuse a coach's decision. Sometimes you can be caught in the data a little too much. I always say in critical moments, and this is kind of where I want to go with this, is the critical moments in a game, particularly in the red zone, think players, not plays. I think that's important. But I think you have to be armed with information to make sure that you make the best decision possible. Let's go, for example, a play that a lot of people remember. And I kind of thought about what to talk about. And to talk about something that a lot of people may not have been familiar with or saw, maybe wasn't as good. So let's go back to the Super Bowl, the Seattle-New England Super Bowl that ended on the Malcolm Butler interception. What was Seattle thinking? What was Pete Carroll thinking? Why did they do what they did? Well, let me just explain what led to that decision and why they did it. Not to say that they did it right or made the right decision, but it, you know, wasn't something that Pete Carroll and Darrell Bell, with his offensive coordinator, just said, "Just how about we just do this?" It was a lot of forethought. So let's go back to that game before that play. We talked a little bit about game plans during the game day, adjustments. What have you done? You break that down at halftime. Well, you've got all that information, and you're charting it during the game, and you update it during the game. Your quality control coaches do. During that game, Seattle had faced second or third and two or less 5 times in that game. Twice in the first half. The Seahawks faced the 3rd and 2 twice. They ran Marshawn Lynch. On the first series, he was stopped for no gain. Late in the second quarter, he scored on a 3-yard touchdown. They faced 3 similar situations in the third quarter. 3rd and 1, Lynch stopped for no gain. 2nd and 1, Lynch ran for 3 yards. And 3rd and 2, Wilson threw an incompletion. So, 4 short down yardage situations to run the ball to that point in the game. Twice Lynch converted, twice he was stopped. So there was nothing there that said, man, he was stopped 4 times. Man, he made it 4 times. It was kind of a, you know, he stopped 2 times. And he was successful 2 times. Now, you had the New England personnel grouping. This is important to understand. This affects what you do. And a lot of times people don't get it. Hey, it's 3rd and short, you're running. Hey, folks, don't tell me what you would run unless you understand what the front in the coverages. If you can't identify what defense is doing and what personnel is in the game and how they're playing it, don't tell me what play call you call, because you're just guessing. And guessing is not what we do. New England had four defensive linemen, four linebackers, and three corners. They were loading up to stop the run. Okay. This was more of a loaded front look than they had on the other four carries that we just enumerated. Now, you normally don't show your hand defensively before the offense can send its personnel in the game. Bill Belichick purposely in this situation showed what he was doing. Why? He didn't want Seattle to run Lynch. He thought that was going to be the toughest thing for them to defend. So he put his run defense in, a strong personnel grouping of run defense, to discourage Seattle from running and to better able to stop the run if they did run it. Three corners suggest to Seattle that perhaps their best opportunity to throw a football would be on second down. Okay? Throwing from the one-yard line is not that unconventional. Certainly in the NFL. That's what we're talking about here. But what you normally like to do is design a play for the quarterback to throw either to the boundary or the back of the end zone. So you're throwing a touchdown or you're throwing it away. An incompletion wouldn't be a problem. 5 or 6 seconds might come off the clock, but there would be time to run two more plays. With one timeout left, they could even run the ball on third down and still be able to stop the clock if you didn't score. But if you run the ball on second and don't get in, you have to use your final timeout. And then everybody knows that you got to throw on the next play. So for all the information, the personnel, the previous results, the down and distance, the location on the field, the timeouts, the clock, add up to a definitive conclusion. Throw the ball now. So actually, throwing the ball there on that play, and of course all people think about it, yes, you had to run it because it was intercepted and the game was over. Well, people just in their mind assumed that that was the last play of the game. Well, it didn't have to be. What they could have done is thrown the ball, perhaps on a different route, a safer route that I just discussed, in order to give them an opportunity to run the football again and not put them in that situation. It was definitely the best time to try to throw it, because you still have the opportunity to run it. Throw that route is risky. You got a chance. That play was a 50-50. I mean, there's, you know, a probably 40-40-10. 40% chance you complete that, and it's all about, you know, just crossing the face of the corner, Malcolm Butler, and it's a touchdown. He crosses your face, it's an interception. Or one of them, whoever crosses the face of the other, drops the ball and it's an incompletion. That's probably a 10% chance. But it's 40-40, and I don't like those odds. I like the chances of giving myself multiple opportunities. You've got time. You've got downs. Throw it. I'm throwing something that's safe, that's absolutely a completion or an incompletion, because I'm throwing it away. I mean, it's there's no chance of an interception because I'm not going to throw it anywhere near a defender. Just going to have to be my guy catching it or no one. So I don't think that throwing it was a bad call there, but I think throwing what they threw was not the right call. And if you throw the incompletion, you got Marshawn Lynch for another shot. But I think it's important to understand that with one timeout left, you could run the ball on third down, still be able to stop the clock. But if you run the ball on second down, which this was, and you don't get in, you got your final timeout. Now you're going to have to throw it against the pass or run the risk of running it and the clock runs out. They're throwing it 100% on that last play if you have to do it. So the throwing the football on that situation, you need to understand it a little bit. Give yourself the best options. Throwing the football where it's going to be a touchdown or an incompletion is the goal there. You can't throw an interception. So the play there was risky. The play call, the type of throw was risky. But you probably win the game if you throw a different route. Let's say it's incomplete. You could then run the ball to Lynch on third down and still be able to stop the clock if you didn't score. Because, again, you didn't use your timeout because of the quick pass that was an incomplete or a touchdown, right? But running the ball on second down, it's you've basically taken a down away from yourself. Because you either get in and you win, which is all people think about. But if you don't get in, you're calling a timeout. Now you got no timeouts. Now you can't run it. You've eliminated the run option. Think things through, folks, and understand it, that there's a lot more to it. Couple of questions that we'll end with today. Do coaches incorporate the information about specific officiating crews in their weekly game plans? Absolutely you do. That's a job that's assigned to one of your staff, your quality control coaches. And, you know, what each line judge, the back judge, what they do. You will you may have an umpire that calls a lot of holding. So you communicate that. You teach it. You make sure that you guys understand it, that you're going to probably get a lot more holding. You may even, as a head coach, you will work the officials before the game. You will talk to them about, hey, look, this is what we do. This is what we teach. We're not holding, so don't be – you know, getting itchy, trigger finger, and think we're holding, because that's not what we're doing. So there are a lot of things that you try to do. You can even send some stuff in advance to the league to say, hey, this back judge is calling an inordinate amount of pass interferences, and they're just not, you know, valid. I think you need to do that. If you got an offensive tackle that holes, you may send that in. So you do discuss that, and you do teach your players that, and that's very, very important. Another thing is that we'll end on this for today is, how do you deal with the short week? And the biggest short week we have now in pro football is Thursday night football. We don't really have the short week in the NFL in college football, because if you play on Thursday night, you're not playing on Saturday, and you'll play the next week, so you'll have a little more than a week. And you, there's nobody that's playing on a Saturday and then playing on a Sunday. Playing on a Thursday. They've got that that Saturday off before that. Nobody does that in college, unless they're playing on Thursday, you know, 2 or 3 weeks in a row. They may do that, and some of the smaller conferences do that. But it really is more applicable in the NFL, where you're going to be playing before. We need to have better scheduling. I'm a big believer in having a 20-week season, not 20 games, not 18 games. Keep it at 16, but 20 weeks, where everybody has double byes, and nobody plays on Thursday night unless they have a bye week prior to that. We're not there. I don't know if we're going to get there. It's fallen on deaf ears to this point. But here's what you do in a shortened week. You bring your guys in on Monday. You talk them through and walk through the installation of the game plan. You do it again on Tuesday and again on Wednesday, and you do your goal line walk through, and you have your travel to the game road teams that you get out there on Wednesday. On the home teams, you go through walk through before you leave, or do the walk through if you're the home team there. Really tough for the road team, because remember, Wednesday is like Saturday. Wednesday's travel day. Tuesday's like Friday. Monday's like Wednesday. So Wednesday's game plan day. So Monday, the day after the game of a Thursday week game, you play on Sunday, and you're getting ready to play this coming Thursday. Monday's game plan. You got to walk through the game plan. You physically have to save your guys. From a game plan standpoint, you have to have your quality control guys coach and teach break down the film of the upcoming opponent. You have to break that down sooner. You have to double up, because you have to be ready Sunday night to have the game plan and the film breakdowns done, because Monday is basically Wednesday, a normal Wednesday. We call it a Wednesday Monday. So there's a lot of things that go into it and a lot of extra preparation that's done. And you simplify things. It helps when you're playing a divisional game. We always encourage the league to, if you're going to do that, at least schedule a division game. You know your division opponents best. And you can't do this in the early part of the season, but if you play a division opponent and you're playing them on Thursday night for the second time, it helps. If you're playing early in the year, if you got a Thursday night game in the first 4 weeks of the season, well, it's pretty obvious what you do. Okay? Your quality control guys need to be breaking down your opponent that you're playing next week, but also breaking down that opponent for that Thursday game in, say, week four. Let's use that as an example. And you need to stay ahead of it so that when it's time, you're done that Sunday night before the next week's Thursday game, you've got the film breakdowns inputted in the computer and you're ready to go for Monday walkthrough, and that's what you do. You will, I think, economize what you do, what you call, what you teach, because there's less time to do it. If you're playing it earlier in the season, you've got time in the off season to prepare for the personnel and to get a look at the team in preseason, although that's very vanilla. And you got in the early part of the week, you can break it down. Here's the thing. It's week two of the NFL season. Well, you're playing an opponent this coming week. You played one game. They played one game. So you don't have as much film to break down. You don't have four games to break down. You've just each played one. Well, guess what? You're going to spend that time, that extra time breaking down that opponent you're going to play week four on Thursday night. You spend that extra time doing that. Now, if you play them later in the season, if you play a Thursday night later in the season, then that becomes more difficult to track, because you got to get at least four games in. But that's why we always like to encourage, if you're going to do that to us, at least give us a division opponent to where we know that team the best. We may have even played them before, and we've got an installed game plan that we've used. You can do that later in the season because you've had more games in which you've played, and the likelihood that maybe you're playing this team for the second time is greater than if you played them in the early part of the season. So follow me. If you play later, you hope that you played someone that you're familiar with, that you've in your division, that you've played before already, you've already broken down enough film. If you're playing in the early part of the season, you don't have as much film to break down because your opponent hadn't played as many games. So the answer is you simplify it, and two, you have to stay ahead with your breakdowns before it. So good questions and good ideas on that. All right, folks, we appreciate it. Hope you're enjoying this X's and O's series. Give me feedback. Let me know. I ask questions on this or anything else. Check out LandryFootball.com for all the latest notebooks, news, and information around the league and around college football, as well as the breakdowns of all the rosters at the college and NFL level. Appreciate you joining us, everybody. Talk to you again next Tuesday in another edition of the Landry Football Podcast on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles quick fix on Radio Influence.
Now, Calvin Johnson, you remember that name, the wide receiver from the Lions. If you remember how Calvin Johnson went out, he kind of retired, you know, before it was his time. I didn't know that he was battling a lot of knee problems, you know, bone on bone, cartilage on cartilage. He didn't practice at the end of his career, and he just had enough. So when he retired, the Detroit Lions made him give back part of his guaranteed money. So when he retired, because of his body being beat up from playing for the Lions his whole career, the Lions had the audacity to make him pay back over $1 million. So then, when they call Calvin Johnson, hey, Calvin, how you doing? You want to represent our team? F you, period. And he came out, and I believe this wholeheartedly. He came out and says, you want me to represent the Lions? You gave me my damn money back. Good for you, Calvin. So when a billionaire hits a young man for $1 million, a billionaire, knowing that he left blood and guts on the field, screw him. The Fords, they need $1 million? Since when? Good for you, Calvin. Good for you. Don't sign nothing with the Lions on it. I wouldn't. Those guys treated you like, you know, Willie Lump Lump. Don't let them do that, okay? So good for you, Calvin Johnson, and I hope he never represents the Lions if they don't give him his damn money back. That's it.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.